Lovely to have you with us, Rod Oram.
Good morning.
So Friday, your assessment on it. We talked to Leila Harrow yesterday and Matthew Hooton. You were there. What is your assessment of whether it was a significant event that will bring some changes?
Let me just deal with a few broad themes and then sort of explore each of them in detail. The first thing is some tangible results will come out of the Job Summit if, and this is quite a big if, the subsequent analysis and execution are very good. So in other words, there were some germs of ideas there that need a lot further development. Secondly, though, the summit, to one extent, failed to meet its own criteria, which was very practical, near-term things to do, because about half the 21 ideas in the final cut were very woolly and long-term, and thus failing that practical and ready-soon criteria. That's very important because, I mean, nobody can forecast what's going on with the world economy or the New Zealand economy, but certainly the next 6 months are going to be very difficult. And if we're going to put some job creation and support things in place, they need to be up and running very fast. And that doesn't, you know, that's not how some of the ideas came up. I think on the positive side, there was a good mood of cooperation and engagement amongst the people there, and I'd love to see that continued. The basic line that Andrew Grant from McKinsey used was that people representing 80% of the GDP of New Zealand were in the room. That may be roughly right, but it was exciting to see that, and almost everybody, as far as I could tell, did park their ideology at the door and was looking for constructive things. So that was very good. And I suppose, lastly, and this is what gives me a good deal of concern, the summit was very inward-looking. And whilst there was very good international perspective injected by Alan Bollard, the Reserve Bank governor, and Andrew Grant from McKinsey, a Kiwi who used to run the New Zealand practice of McKinsey, but now is senior in their Chinese team, you know, that was hardly ever reflected in the discussions. And I think that's a mistake because what's going on in the world is big and is going to have an impact on us.
What do you make of some of what has grabbed the headlines in terms of proposals, some of the big ideas that seem to have been given the most credibility?
The three big ones that were picked up was, first of all, the 9-day fortnight with the idea that people would train on the 10th day. Sounds almost biblical. And that's okay in broad principle. And, you know, in a sense, it's nicely egalitarian that we can help save a mate's job by working a bit less and spend the time training so we're better workers. But this is where the complexity starts to come in. That's going to be very hard for many employers to organize within their own workforces, the first problem. The second one is there is not an abundant supply of sort of short courses that could be useful there. Yes, there are the likes of very good industry training programs and apprenticeships and the rest. But there's going to have to be a big scramble to organize the sort of program that would work in that context. And the last thing is that it's going to be sort of a moot point about how many jobs will be saved. I could imagine the situation that an employer has some people that he or she particularly values and have some particular skills, and the employer will want to support them in that way. But I'd have thought there are going to be quite a few people who employers feel are expendable in the sense of easy to let go now and easy to rehire somebody similar later, who won't get this opportunity and will still drop onto the unemployment rolls.
Is it realistic, that 70,000 figure? Saving 70,000 jobs seems extraordinary.
It's a very big number, and of course we'll never accurately be able to measure that, but it would be a good goal to get something like that number of people into employment training programs. But as I say, there's a huge gearing up exercise there.
What about this idea of the big investment fund, which we're now finding out may have been something that Australia already had underway? What would it be used for? What difference could it make, I guess, in the current environment?
The very big difference between what the Australians are doing with theirs and what we would do here is that the Australians are using it to prop up their property sector, particularly commercial and industrial, I believe, rather than residential. And there's no intention to do that here. Actually, our sectors there are not in too bad a shape at the moment. So this is the idea that otherwise good companies might be struggling through these tight times, and rather than taking on more debt, it'd be helpful if they had equity instead. So the idea is that would be a chunk of government money and private sector money, like from the banks, that would be a fund that would then invest in those good companies. It's an interesting political sleight of hand, if you like, because it means that the government doesn't have to get into that awkward position of picking which failing companies to support. What it's going to be doing is picking the best of the bunch that are still tracking well to give them more support. And again, you have to ask, where is the current failure in the capital markets that's not providing that capital? And there may be an argument that there is a failure in the capital markets, but that this new fund is going to have to be designed very carefully to make sure that you don't sort of screw the scrum in an unfortunate way.
Who would run it? How exactly would it work? Or is that just not been threshed out?
This is completely up in the air. And fortunately, we've had some good experience over the last 6 or 7 years in devising funds, such as the Venture Investment Fund and the Seed Fund on the venture capital and new business side. So there is some good expertise there. But what we found with those funds is that they are, I always hate to use the word, but they're quite, well, I'll use the word process-driven rather than bureaucratic. And it's going to be a bit of a challenge to design a new fund that can respond fast, because I can't emphasize enough that we really need to be focusing on these next 6 months. Mm.
Well, interesting you should talk about that, because we had the venture capitalist Jenny Morell on very recently, who made it clear that her and indeed just about every other venture capital fund that is running is fully booked at the moment. She is looking at trying to get another fund up and running.
Yeah.
But there's little out there for anyone looking for those kinds of funds at the moment. You keep talking about this urgency to move. What sort of time frame do you believe some of these initiatives have to be up and running in?
If they could be done, devised and got up and running, and even started in pilot form, which I think would be very sensible, so you could make some quick adjustments rather than trying to design the perfect model, in the next month or two. I think that the time, you know, we've got to get these things bedded in and prove to be working by the time life gets harder.
The cycle way, everyone seems to be polarised on this. Either it's a fantastic idea and long overdue, or it's barking mad. Where do you sit on it?
Well, listeners will know from the occasional comment that I cycle a bit. So in the sense, I have a vested interest. And I'll actually bring in one more personal thing. A friend from Whanganui is, with one of his friends, is cycling from Cape Reinga to Bluff. And Mark was looking for guidance across Auckland in the absence of a national cycleway. So I met him at the ferry terminal this morning. We cycled down here to Papakura.
Well, that's two of you for $50 million. That's great.
Look, a whole bunch of serious things here. First of all, it can't be an end-to-end route, because that's like just having State Highway 1 and no other roads. This needs to be a network. Secondly, actually, a lot of work has been going on about this through people like the Cycling Advocates Network. And the key word is a network. The next thing is, there is no way that much of this can be built fast, because you can adopt some existing cycleways. You could go into local council plans where they've got some, you know, well-developed plans for cycleways, but have got no money to build them, so the government could fund that. But at the moment, you'd only be trying to put some of those key pieces in place, because actually devising the whole route or the major part of the network, and the Cycling Advocates Network call their idea Freeway Zero, is that that's going to take a long time. Secondly, there ain't no way that you can do this for $50 million. This is a much bigger sum and a much longer term one. Now, I think the benefits are huge. I think it's something that New Zealanders would enjoy, but it's obviously something that the sort of overseas tourists who are more likely still to come in hard times, i.e. the free independent travellers who want to have a bit of an adventure, would use a lot. And so I think there's great benefit.
Actually, an interesting letter to the paper yesterday saying, would this route include the cycleway across the Auckland Harbour Bridge, which might get rather more use by domestic folk?
I think that would be a splendid idea.
Okay. You've got some other ideas out of the summit you're a bit more lukewarm on. What are they?
Well, here's another big point, that there were some ideas that would be okay if they were done in a different way than were proposed. And my favourite on that one is that there's talk of having a $60 million public-private fund to boost tourism. Now, we don't know any of the details on this, but it would, I would argue it would be a huge mistake if it was just a question of cobbling together an extra $60 million to throw at marketing through our existing marketing channels. Because what's going on in our traditional markets, i.e. the middle classes of North America, Europe and Asia, they are seriously financially stressed and worried about their jobs and their economic prospects. And so a bit more tourism advertising won't change their minds. That's the first problem. The second one is there is an upsurge of tourist advertising around the world because there are parts of the world which are suffering far more than us. So, for example, I was reading something the other day about the Caribbean. About a third of the tourism capacity in the Caribbean is lying idle at the moment. And so there's extraordinary deals and everything else. So I would argue, get some money together, but don't spend it on those traditional routes. Instead, start exploring new channels, particularly social networking, you know, via the web and such ways, to find new markets and new potential tourists. And again, that won't be a fast solve. And the numbers in tourism are critical. I mean, one of the figures that we used at the summit was that if tourism numbers dropped by 15%, and I'm not forecasting that, but one could see how that might happen, that would probably result, I'm not sure where this data has come from, in 27,000 jobs lost in the tourism industry. So there is an important point there about trying to stimulate tourism demand, but there's just no point in trying to stimulate it in the old ways.
And the ugly out of the conference, what do you think absolutely should be left on the floor?
Some things were unbelievably predictable. These are good things, but this is the work of a lifetime to get them right. Sorry, I exaggerate. I hope we could do it quicker than that. But here are some of them. Ensure government services to Maori deliver results. Well, that's important, but you can't turn that on. Task forces to streamline and cut costs of compliance. Task force to help major projects through to realization. Keep people in education and create jobs through education and training. Stop all new regulations unless improved by ministers. I mean, those are worthy sentiments that we should work on, but there's no way you could make meaningful progress on any of those, you know, in the next, you know, 2 years, let alone the next 6 months.
What happens next? I guess they go off and they work on a bunch of ideas and we may or may not see them in the budget. But in terms of the summit process, will these big heads, this 80% of GDP that you talk about, meet again?
John Key said at the end that he didn't expect to have the likes of such meetings regularly. And I think that's right in one sense. They could get a little too routine. But I'd like to see them more often than we've had them in the past. But the work now largely falls to the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet to process these ideas and develop them. There is a chance that some of them, the easier ones to implement, might get a look in at the budget. But it's getting quite late in terms of the budget preparation cycle, I mean, even though it's not till the end of May, to get anything substantive in there. I should imagine the government just might earmark a pool of money in the budget for things that then, you know, could develop later. And lastly, the Prime Minister said he would get back together with the people who headed up each of the work streams in the summit, the various chairs of those bits of work, in the next 6 to 8 weeks to let them know what the progress is.
Thanks so much for your time. Rod Oram, our business commentator.